Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A little relief in the stock market at the beginning of this week, but what a wild ride it's been lately. Oodles of money lost in markets and real estate, and nobody sure where the bottom is. The nest egg nation is nervous, and rightly so. This hour on Point, what to do? We'll talk with top financial advisors from around the country about how to survive and maybe even thrive in this wild market. In a moment, we'll go to our investment pros, but first to Wall Street, where there's been an upstart to this week, or was on Monday, and surprising news in the Bear Stearns rescue story. Peter Coy is economics editor for Business Week magazine. He joins us from New York. Peter, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, first of all, what is your sense of where we are in the story of turmoil that's sort of taken over all the financial markets and a lot of people's thinking about the economy lately? Is there in a sense that we're bottoming out, or are people still waving those fear the depression banners out there somewhere? Where are we in this tale?
I don't see how we can really bottom out as long as house prices are still falling.
11.4% in January, we just heard.
We just saw, news out today. We're down more than 10% over the past year, which is really unprecedented, and there's really not a sign that we're at the bottom of that. So until housing starts to stabilize, I don't think Wall Street can stabilize.
Even though it's going to have these up and down days, and there have been some incredible ones. The volatility in this recent stretch is just off the charts.
Right. And, you know, the latest news is the bailout, as people are calling it, of Bear Stearns.
Mm.
The news that came out is that the J.P. Morgan is increasing its bid for Bear Stearns to try to win the support of Bear shareholders. But to me, the more interesting part is the extensive involvement of the Fed in this thing. You know, the Federal Reserve was supposed to be the anonymous kind of Wizard of Oz pulling the levers to control the money supply. Yet here it is intimately involved in brokering deals between companies and getting its hands right into, in effect, taking over assets of Bear Stearns and making them good. This is raising a lot of hackles. I wrote an article about this for the Business Week website, and we're getting all kinds of comments from people saying, hey, where's my bailout?
Right. Well, explain this to us. When we heard about this first a week and a day or two ago, it was $2 a share. That was just 200 and some million for all of Bear Stearns.
Right.
And people, eyebrows were raised about it, but yet the share price was so low that at least there was a huge wrap of the knuckles in here for Bear Stearns management, not to mention unfortunate shareholders.
Yeah.
But there was all this talk about moral hazard. Now, if suddenly, not only do you have the Fed putting up still something like $29 billion to take over bad assets of Bear Stearns, and J.P. Morgan paying five times as much, $10 a share instead of two, does the moral hazard just explode? Does it become bigger? Does the punishment go away?
That's exactly, you put your finger on it. That's the concern here, is that back when it was $2 a share, I was like, okay, that's very close to zero, which is probably what the Fed would have preferred. The Fed, I think, was behind the scenes trying to keep the number as small as possible, because exactly this, they didn't want to be perceived as, preserving the wealth of the Bear management and shareholders while also putting in money. But unfortunately, the deal couldn't get done at that low price because the Bear shareholders bought, so now it's going up to $10 a share. And of course, the Bear shares are actually trading above 10, meaning people are thinking it might come even higher than that.
But do you mean the whole thing could have unraveled if Bear shareholders wouldn't sign on? What, somebody else might have stepped in and offered more? And why should the Fed stay in the deal when the price is going up so high?
Well, I don't think anybody
or
else...
Or not so high, but higher.
Right. I don't think anybody else was going to come in and try to bid for Bear. The only reason that the deal works at all is that there is this dollop, very large dollop of money from the Fed that's making the Bear assets good. It used to be 30, now $29 billion worth.
Why didn't the Fed just draw a line in the sand then and say, no, if we're going to put up that kind of, if we're going to take over those shaky assets, we're not going to back a deal that's five times more than we agreed?
Well, because the deal just might not have happened, and Bear Stearns was hemorrhaging. It was losing some of its best people, some of its best clients, and the longer that went on, it had to end very quickly, or else J.P. Morgan would have said, it doesn't want any part of Bear at that stage, and we would have been left with this badly wounded firm needing to basically shut its operations down, dumping all kinds of really weak assets on the market, forcing the market price down, which would have hurt the balance sheets of other Wall Street firms and possibly caused a domino reaction.
Peter, last question. Smart money on Wall Street, is it in or out, or in and out of the market these days? I mean, we've got a lot of, you know, ordinary citizens with their nest eggs that they're worried about there. What about the people with many millions at play? Is it clear where they are in this market?
No, it's not. And, you know, it never confuse genius with a bull market. A lot of those people who seem so smart turned out to be really, really stupid, so I wouldn't necessarily follow their lead.
All right. There's advice from Wall Street. Peter Coy, economics editor at Business Week. Thanks a lot for being with us, Peter.
Thank you. Take care.
We're talking this hour about the best ways to protect your nest egg and how to ride out the economic turmoil we've been in the midst of. We have a terrific panel of financial planners with us. Let me introduce them. First, from Denver, Colorado, is Kate Scott, principal at Cherry Hills Investment Advisors. They're headquartered in Littleton, Colorado. Kate, thank you very much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
With us from Kansas City, Missouri, is Cheryl Garrett, founder of the Garrett Planning Network. It's an international network of independent financial advisors based in Shawnee Mission, Kansas. Cheryl Garrett, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Newark, New Jersey, Christopher Cardero, wealth manager and chief investment manager at Regent Atlantic Capital in Chatham, New Jersey. Christopher Cardero, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Chris, just jump in here. Begin to orient our listeners around the kind of advice you're giving to your clients these days. It is scary out there. What are your beginning thoughts on how people with a little something in the market, whether it's, you know, a lot less than they wished or whether it's a substantial sum that they've put together over a lifetime, how should people be thinking about investment and the market and the economy we're facing now?
Well, Tom, I think the biggest issue in the market right now, when you reach a volatile time period, is not to panic, to really step back and understand that when you're talking about investing for your lifetime and for your retirement, that's a very long time horizon. And we're always going to have ups and downs in the market. That's part of why you get compensated more for owning stocks than bonds, because implicitly, you're willing to take that risk that you're going to have more volatility. So I find it helpful to remind clients that that's what they signed on for when they decided to invest in the stock market, and that this is a natural occurrence. There always will be volatility. There always will be good times in the economy and bad times. The best thing you can do is not blow yourself up by panicking and getting in and out of the market. More often than not, that's where investors, especially individual investors, hurt themselves because they try and overtime the market and they end up behind the eight ball.
Keep your cool.
Yes.
I'm looking at a headline here in CNN Money. Keep your cool in a dangerous market. Everybody says don't panic, but Cheryl Garrett, at the same time, we're reading things that many people may never have read before, like, you know, the worst something or other since World War II, or the worst something or other since the Great Depression. You know, fears that we've got a kind of a system failure here. Are the stakes different this time, Cheryl Garrett?
Well, the subject matter is different, but the ramifications may not be any different than at other times that we've seen in our past history. We see consumer sentiment right now at levels that we haven't seen in 35 years. And 35 years ago, we were looking at oil embargoes and Watergate, you know, different scandals, different crises. Right now, I think we have crises going on as far as real estate prices actually coming down to earth, not necessarily blowing up in our face, although it feels like that on an individual level.
Uh-huh.
We had severe overpricing. To me, it's kind of like the tech bubble that many of us talk about in hindsight, but we're talking about real estate, and that touches most everyone's life throughout our entire society.
Mm-hmm.
So this is widespread and massive. The other issue is the overburdening of ourselves with debt, individually and as a society. And that's something that we also have not seen. It's at unprecedented levels, and it needs to be paid down. We need to not be as overextended, over-mortgaged. You know, we've been rolling the dice with the anticipation that real estate prices will keep going up, and we can continue to pay for our lifestyle out of the equity in our homes. And that was bad behavior. It wasn't sound financial management. And unfortunately, it does have to unravel or slow down or stop, and unraveling is what seems to be the case. In the long-term scheme of things, I think this is very healthy for our society.
But it sure feels
painful.
It sure feels bad right now. We're going to come back and look at advice on that front. Kate's got to know you there in Denver. Just a taste of it, Kate. Are your clients nervous out there? What are they asking you?
Our clients are very nervous. In fact, I got a call yesterday from someone, and this is extreme, but I had a client call in and say, I'm thinking about taking all of my money out of the market and putting it in silver or opening a Swiss bank account. I had to say, okay, it's time for us to talk about this. And this is exactly the kind of behavior that investment advisors have to talk their clients out of.
Right, back off that ledge, please. Kate, please stand by in Denver. Cheryl Garrett in Kansas City and Chris Cordero in Newark, New Jersey. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what to do with your nest egg, large or small, in this crazy market, how to survive and maybe thrive in a time of incredible economic uncertainty. We're very lucky to have with us a terrific panel. Chris Cordero joins us from Newark, New Jersey, wealth manager, chief investment manager at Regent Atlantic Capital in Chatham, New Jersey. Cheryl Garrett with us from Kansas City, Missouri. She's a certified financial planner, founder of the Garrett Planning Network. And with us from Denver, Colorado, principal at Cherry Hills Investment Advisors in Littleton, Colorado, is Kate Scott. Calling from Cambridge, New York, up there on the Vermont border, Andrew. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I have a question for your panel. I'm close to retirement age, and I was wondering if there was a sufficient threat of inflation that I should consider TIPS or I-bonds to preserve the principal, and if so, what percentage should I consider putting in those?
Andrew, what does close to retirement age mean in your case?
63.
Okay. Cheryl, let me come to you. He's close to retirement age, worried about inflation, thinking about treasuries, inflation-protected securities. What do you say?
I think that's a good strategy, Andrew. I would be looking at very likely a third of your fixed income portfolio in inflation-protected securities as a standard. I also like to see people going into retirement or living on their nest egg to have one account that is incredibly liquid and stable, that'll take care of 1 year's worth of cash flow, your required monthly living expenses, and then another 2 years worth of very stable and liquid reserves to ride through hard times. So I'm looking at very safe, possibly CDs, treasuries, those types of securities for 3 years worth of required living expenses in retirement. That would be a luxury if you can afford it. Another component that I would love to see in retirees' portfolios is something that will provide a guaranteed income for your lifetime. In addition to Social Security, something like a defined benefit pension plan, and if you don't happen to have one of those, as many of us don't, then I like to annuitize a portion of my nest egg or for my clients' nest eggs so that they do have all of their required living expenses coming to them in automatic payments through a combination of Social Security or some kind of guaranteed income for life.
But if you're looking to put money in an annuity with that guaranteed income right now, are you getting a decent return on that, Cheryl, given all the uncertainty out there?
You're getting the going rate, the guarantee for that security. I mean, you're buying security. You're not getting a giant rate for that, but you are getting something that you cannot outlive. And that security, that stability, when we're talking about making a decision to retire, which for many people is an irrevocable decision, we cannot afford to not have that extra security. So we may be required to give up excess returns or additional returns that we would potentially get by staying fully invested in the financial markets to buy that security for life.
Chris Cordero, it's scariest of all for people who are right around Andrew's age, 63. There's not a lot of time to ride out a longish storm, if that's what we've got here, and recover on the other side. On the other hand, life expectancy is such these days that, I'm looking at your advice. You're saying you can't get out of the game. So what to do, Chris?
Well, that's exactly it. If you look at Andrew's life expectancy and if he's married, life expectancy with his spouse, you've got a shot at easily one of them living well into their 90s. That's a 30-year time horizon for your portfolio to last. So you cannot, just because you're close to retirement, you can't turn it all into cash and put it under your mattress. You've got to have a significant portion of your portfolio still working for you hard in the equity markets. And as scary as that may seem, that's the reality of the situation given our increased life expectancies. So I'd look at someone around his age to have about 60% of their portfolio in equities and the other 40% or so in bonds.
Kate Scott, give us a sense of what inflation can do to a nest egg if you're not making a decent return over time. I mean, we've got a lot of debt here. We've got a lot of, as a country, we've got a lot of debt. People have said one way out of that may be inflation. If it starts to, ratchet up, 3%, 5%, heaven help us, 7, 8, 9%, what does that do to savings?
Well, I think that's one of the points that Chris is making. You really can't afford to have all of your money in fixed income types of investments as you go into an extended retirement period because you're not going to have enough growth in that portfolio. And if you've got 3.5% or 4% or even 5% inflation and you're only getting a 5 or 6% return on your fixed income portfolio, that's not a lot of growth. You want to see at least 3 or 3.5% real return, which is the difference between the return you're making and inflation. Otherwise, you're losing buying power through the years.
So where would you turn for that minimum return now, Kate?
Well, we were talking about the retirement portfolio of a 63-year-old. Mm-hmm. I would agree with Cheryl that you need to have 3 years of really liquid assets, and then you'll have an intermediate portion of your portfolio, which maybe is not terribly risky. It's somewhat conservative, but not as conservative as bonds. And then a portion of your portfolio that really is focused on growth because you're going to need that money further out, say 20 years out, 15 or 20 years out. So again, you're still going to have a diversified portfolio that has a mix of all of the components we normally see in a portfolio, international, U.S., large, mid, and small cap, perhaps some alternative investments in there. It's just going to be in different weightings depending on the individual and their aversion to risk, how comfortable they are with the volatility, such as what we're having right now, and also their age.
Andrew,
so sorry.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to thank Andrew for his call and say he's right to be worried about it. I'm looking at some scary numbers here. Let's say inflation averages 3% over the next 30 years. Which is just about the Fed's long-term target. By the end of three decades, $100,000 is worth about $40,000 in today's dollars. If inflation goes higher, let's say 6%, $100,000 turns into $17,000 in today's dollars. And if it goes off the charts at 10%, $100,000 becomes $5,700 in today's dollars. You're right to be watching that, Andrew. I hope that's helpful. Let's go to the other end of the age scale, and Chris in Amherst, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think? What do you know?
Well, I don't know what to think. That's why I'm calling. my question is, I'm just about to graduate in May, and I'm wondering, should I be trying to take advantage of some of these sort of low rates and stuff that you guys are talking about, or should I not even be thinking about that until I try and clear myself from my student debt?
So you're in your 20s?
Yep, 23.
And how much student debt do you have, if we may ask?
It's about $30,000.
$30,000. Have you got a job lined up yet, Chris?
Not quite yet. I'm still still working on that.
Right. That's where you're headed, and we wish you luck with that. But you're going to be thinking about these issues as you head into it. Chris Cordero, what about a young person in Chris's situation, you know, looking out at the investment picture right now as he begins to make a living? What should he be thinking about what to do looking at a market like this one?
Well, in a market like this one, I think he should focus on two things. One, he should focus on paying down his student loan debt. And at the same time, assuming he lands a job that has a 401k plan, he should be looking to actively participate in that. And this way, you're doing both things at the same time. As young as Chris should be buying into just about all equities in their retirement account. And I think if you look back in 5 or 10 years, you'll look at 2008 and say that was a good time to start buying equities. So that part will work well for him. And then paying down his student loan debt so he can get that monkey off of his back sooner rather than later.
But what about if there's a continuing downside here? I mean, you know, here I'm reading, there's a column in front of me talking about epic financial crisis. We've heard people talk about the Great Depression or reference back to the time in the 70s where stocks barely budged for years and years. Could we be going into a time like that? Could it be a mistake for Chris, even as young as he is, to be putting his money in the stock market? Or, you know, can you say with certainty that it's not a mistake or that he has to do it? What?
Well, even going back to the 70s would be a great example. If Chris started saving in the 70s and diligently saved through the 70s and 80s, at some point in time, we don't know when the bottom will hit, mm-hmm. but it will hit and will start coming out the other side. So if you're an active saver right now, you're looking at better opportunities to put your money to work than we had 2 or 3 years ago.
So maybe opportunity right there, and you've got time to let it happen. Chris, thanks for that. Let's go to Prescott, Michigan, and Alan. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, nest egg for most average Americans is their Social Security. If the U.S. Treasury continues to bail out the richer savings of richer Americans like Mr. Stearns, are they violating the contract U.S. Treasury has of paying back the IOUs they owe the Social Security Trust Funds where the surplus has been put in U.S. Treasuries?
Well, let us look at it. Kate Scott, how about it? You know, for the little guy out there without a lot of skin in the game, to see these big sums that the Fed is pushing to help out Bear Stearns, on the one hand, we want them to keep the economy steady. On the other, you hear the kind of question it brings us here from Michigan. This gets into where your professional life may hit your politics, Kate. I don't know, but what do you say to Alan?
Well, I will say, first of all, that it's all part of the same system, and I think that the government is stepping in because it feels that the risk to the total system is such that it can't afford to do that. I'm not a big fan of government bailouts, and it's really only in hindsight that you can see whether it made sense or not. For example, if you recall the Chrysler bailout that happened, that was mm-hmm. pretty odd, I thought, at the time. The federal savings and loan bailout, which cost us a lot of money, did it make sense? I'm not sure. I'm not sure we got our money's worth out of it. But with respect to Social Security, I don't think it has it's not a direct threat to Social Security. I don't think that the country will allow that safety net to fail. There may be asset tests and other considerations going forward as to who's going to get Social Security and how much, but I don't think that we're not going to let the little people fall. Let's put it that way.
Cheryl Garrett, are you so confident for people who are depending to a large degree on Social Security that they can look ahead and see that as their backstop?
Definitely for the next couple of decades. After that, I really can't guess what the future will bring. I definitely agree with Kate that some significant changes, I'm carrying her thought a little bit further than I think she implied, maybe, that some changes will have to be made with the Social Security system to keep it viable, so that we can afford to take care of Medicare, Medicaid, and also additional programs like our Federal Reserve stepping in and providing lending to investment banks. From a policy decision, I don't know for sure how I feel about it, and I'm tending to lean kind of negative on whether or not I think this is the right approach for our Federal Reserve. However, I am in the minority in that thinking, and so I'm hoping that everyone else is right, and this is the appropriate action. I see that as far as a more near-term concern is not a worry about the Social Security system or the viability there, but rather the weakening of the U.S. dollar worldwide.
Mm-hmm. If you're ambivalent about it, I'm not sure what the rest of us are supposed to think, but you're right. A lot of people are saying it had to be done just now. Let's go to Tony in Columbia, South Carolina. Tony, what's your question?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm 50 years old.
Okay.
Recently unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
House is paid for. Have about $100,000 in assets.
Okay.
Mostly liquid. Money market and short-term bonds.
So you've got $100,000 beyond the house, which is paid off, and you're 50 without a job at the moment.
Exactly. Besides finding employment.
Yes, and good luck with that.
What should I do with my nest egg to protect it from inflation and maybe get some growth?
Chris, you hear Tony's situation, and Tony, we wish you luck on a job ASAP. He's got $100,000. It's not a fortune, but it's what he's got. What should he do with it, Chris?
Well, given that Tony's unemployed right now, I think he really needs to keep a large part of that liquid. So I think the way he has it positioned right now is entirely appropriate. The parts that I would sort of segment out is I'm not sure if he's got all of that in taxable assets or some of that in retirement plan assets. If he has some in IRA assets, then I would section that off and say you can. That part you could be a little bit more aggressive with.
Tony, how about it? Is some of it in an IRA or a 401k, anything like that?
Yes, I do. I do have about 15,000 of it is in an IRA, in a Roth IRA.
Right. And when you get to retirement age, do you have a pension coming or not?
No, probably not.
Like a lot of people.
I do have a lot of equity in my home, though.
No, that's great.
Recent appraisal on my home was about $400,000.
That's great, and you've managed to pay off the mortgage by the time you're 50, which is terrific.
I've seen great appreciation in the value of the property.
Yeah, no, that's good luck. So, Chris, he's got $15,000 in an IRA. The rest, more liquid. How about that bit?
Sure. So the $15,000 that's in the IRA, I would keep that invested very aggressively to guard against inflation. You know, I'd recommend some portion of that to go into commodities. If you're, we talked about TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The trouble with them right now is there's been such a fear of inflation mm-hmm. that the yields on TIPS have gone way down. Mm-hmm. For the 10-year TIP, it's down around 1%. So you're not getting a lot of extra return above inflation. And those securities will change in price in the marketplace. If you look at commodities, you'll get a good inflation protection from commodities and hopefully a better return. And then also stocks are a very good long-term hedge against inflation because if you think about stocks are just owning companies. And as the companies are able to increase their prices because of inflation, their earnings should increase. So over long periods of time, stocks will help guard against inflation and erosion of your purchasing power.
And what kind of commodities right now? We see oil down a little bit. Are you saying, like, I don't know, whispering, get into gold or copper or who knows what here?
Well, I wouldn't parse it that much. I would take a broad – there are investments available now that will give you a broad spectrum of commodities across an index. And that's the way I would suggest investing in them.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what to do with your nest egg, large or small, in this crazy market we're in the moment. We've got three terrific financial planners with us. Chris Cordero from Newark is with us from Newark, New Jersey, wealth manager, chief investment manager at Regent Atlantic Capital in Chatham, New Jersey. Cheryl Garrett is joining us from Kansas City. She's founder of the Garrett Planning Network out of Shawnee Mission, Kansas. And Kate Scott's here from Denver, Colorado. She's principal at Cherry Hills Investment Advisor in Littleton, Colorado. Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. My question is a little maybe more macroeconomic or historical.
It's, okay.
Somebody mentioned the overextended credit problem in, individually and societally, that it's unprecedented. The question is comparing what we have now to the late 20s when, you know, you read about how everybody had margins and buying stocks on margin and the whole society was kind of floating until the crash happened. And
right.
It created the biggest depression. So so is it a lot more now or less? And if it's less, why are we, you know, why back then did it create the Great Depression? And now they're just talking, oh, yeah, it'll be a nine-month recession.
Well, are you talking a lot more or less what, Tom? More
proportionally, how many more people now are overextended in credit?
Yeah.
Compared to the 20s, when you read historically, that's what one of the problems was that created the Depression.
Right. Let us pick it up. I don't know who wants to pick that up. Who's the historian among us here? Kate, Cheryl, Chris? Tom's looking for some comparison between the, you know, sort of 1929 situation and where we stand right now.
I'm definitely...
jump in, anybody.
I'll jump in.
Okay.
Okay.
Cheryl, I think I hear you there.
Yes, thanks. Tom, I was the one who mentioned something about the overextended status of our average citizen as far as their amount of debt. And there is some remarkable differences between the crash of the 20s and the subsequent Great Depression and where we're at right now. The investors on Wall Street had the ability to borrow significantly more money as far as their leverage on their margin accounts than we're allowed to today. So investors, shy of some hedge funds and people that are working in that kind of investment arena, which is actually quite tiny compared to the grand scheme of investors, we don't have a overextendedness as far as investors go. However, we have something in the consumer debt area, such as home mortgages and consumer debt, auto loans, business loans, student loans, credit card debt that we've never had before. Statistically, I don't know how you measure the difference, but they are very, very different animals. So with the debt on Wall Street is definitely in the crash of the Great Depression, or leading to the Great Depression, was directly tied to the leverage involved in the stock market. The leverage that we're dealing with now is hitting us at home and basically not being able to make ends meet, possibly having more foreclosures. Foreclosures on homes are up 60% year over year last month. So we're seeing more people not being able to stretch their paycheck far enough. They do have some additional options. You know, potentially they may be able to reduce some costs. They may be able to increase their wages or their income so that they can make that stretch and be able to pay those debts. So I don't believe it's going to be nearly as abrupt or severe over the short term. However, I do believe that we have to deal with this overextendedness of the credit situation, that it's really a cash flow crunch rather than a credit crunch.
Mm-hmm. Chris Kader, let me ask you about that. I mean, I want to ask all of you about the, I don't know, the little voice in the back of your minds. A lot of investors worry, what if this is a really big meltdown that we're somehow in the midst of here now? Cheryl says the hedge funds are a relatively small portion of all the investment, and yet they're quite large and they're quite aggressive. I'm reading Ben Stein here in the New York Times on Sunday, and he says, you know, the new element here is the hedge funds, and they're changing Wall Street from a financing entity into a market manipulation entity. It says hedge funds have changed the stock market into a chamber of horrors, and the retirement hopes of tens of millions of Americans will be dashed. Chris, you're a wealth manager, so you must deal with people with some pretty big bucks. Are you worried that the whole thing could go poof, boom?
I'm not worried it's going to go poof, boom. I think there are a lot of differences between, let's say, what occurred in the Great Depression and what we're seeing right now. I'll also, you know, we're talking about the Federal Reserve and the job they're doing. I think they're doing a great job. I think that we are in different times, and it calls for different measures. The job of the Federal Reserve is really to keep the financial markets running and running smoothly. And where they've had to come in and take some creative and aggressive action, they've done it, and they've done so quickly to keep confidence in the markets. And in the end, we can get through this situation if we sort of remain calm and have confidence. And you're seeing a lot of areas right now in the market where people are so scared that they're really acting without thinking. So I don't see a big meltdown coming. You know, Ben Steins usually has such a calming voice. Maybe when he writes, it comes out a little differently. But I saw him over the weekend also. Yeah. Talking about the differences between the Great Depression and how we're not going to end up in a depression. Yeah, we'll have a recession. We've had them before. We'll have them again, but we'll get through it. I highly doubt whether we'll enter into a huge financial meltdown where people are going to be wiped out completely. We've learned too much from our history, and I think the Federal Reserve is really taking appropriate action and making sure we don't get there.
We hope you're right. Kate, I want to get you on that, but let's go to a call first. Karen in Providence, Rhode Island. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, in late 2001, I purchased a number of stocks. The market was low at that time. And now as I look back at where I purchased them and where I am now, it's been 8 years. And I'm right back where I started.
Was it a mutual fund or individual stocks, Karen?
Individual stocks.
Mm-hmm. So you, as they say, chose poorly because there's been a big run-up since then, or was.
I had a big run-up, and then, of course, now they're right back down.
Yeah.
And now I'm in a situation where I have a number of CDs. I have some cash, and I have some CDs maturing, and, of course, the rates are down. And perhaps now is a good time to buy additional stocks, but you know, looking at 8 years with zero return, I feel a little discouraged.
Kate, what do you say to Karen?
Well, first of all, I would ask, how many stocks do you own, and are they over a broad range of industries, or are they concentrated in one industry, for example?
I would say that I own, I'm not sure exactly, but probably five or six, maybe seven. They are mostly blue chips, but I do have a couple of tech stocks. And big ones. Nothing small, nothing risky.
Okay, well, the first thing I would say is that modern portfolio theory, which most consumers are not really familiar with, would say that unless you have at least 30 stocks, you cannot diversify away company-specific risks. So what that means is, in addition to having just market risks, with the market going up and down, you have concentrated risk in those particular companies that you own. And as financial advisors, that's one of the things that we try to get away from and try to get our clients to be more diversified. And so what you own is not, in my opinion, adequate diversification. I would rather see you in some different mutual funds that would diversify you across industries and across quite a few more companies, and then also possibly into some international stocks. And that would give you, over the long run, a better, more stable return than what you have currently.
Cheryl, what do you say about diversification these days? You know, financial planners always talk about it. Is there a formula that you're offering people these days? What kind of diversity of investments they have to have?
Definitely nothing new or different than what we've been preaching for a good number of years is, like Kate has said, that folks need to be broadly diversified in different asset classes and across a number of securities and sectors. We want to have foreign investments. I also like mutual funds. A few of my favorite mutual fund managers who were not taking new investment dollars in the last few years because they could not figure out a place to invest this money, such as the Dodge & Cox Stock Fund, Longleaf Partners, Third Avenue Value, or International Value, rather. Those managers were some of my favorite ones, and they closed to new investment for quite a number of years. They've recently reopened or are getting ready to reopen because they are seeing investment opportunities out there for long-term investors. These managers are value-oriented investors. They're looking for stocks that have been they're very underpriced relative to their future opportunities and relative to their peer group. Possibly with just a handful of five or six stocks, Karen is very concentrated, as Kate suggested. She's in likely large cap U.S. conglomerates, needs some smaller company, needs some foreign exposure, and just as Chris mentioned to another caller, some commodities exposure very likely might be appropriate as well. We are suggesting that for clients, and a couple of ways to obtain that commodity exposure for average investors or non-institutional investors would be through exchange-traded funds like PowerShares DB Commodities Index Tracking Fund, the ticker symbol is DBC, or the iShares S&P Goldman Sachs Commodities Index Fund, and that's GSG. Those are two exchange-traded funds that will enable people to buy into a bucket of commodities stocks, so they get some broad diversification without buying individual securities.
Karen, there's a path back in if you've got the stomach for it, and thank you for your call. Chris Cordero, on the foreign investment front, a lot of Americans have dipped their toe in a lot more in that in recent years. A lot of that money went into Asian stocks. Now every day for the last couple of weeks anyway, we've heard from Asia again and again, down here, down there, down there. I can imagine people thinking, what have I done? I've gone off to join the Asian boom and now it's all going away. What do you say about that front?
Well, what happened in Asia and specifically China is that China had a is actually still in the middle of a bubble that reaches that is far larger than our internet bubble was. The Shanghai index went up 135% in 2006. It went up 98% in 2007. So far this year, it's down 30% because it went up so high those 2 years. And if we look at valuations, at the end of 2007, the Shanghai index was selling for a 45 PE multiple.
Wow.
The higher the number, the more expensive the stocks are.
Sort of double what you'd expect or hope for, or more.
Yes, and if you compare that to where the S&P 500 was in March of 2000 at the top of our tech bubble, the PE there was only 31. So that's what we're really seeing in Asia is the cooling off of China, and I'd say China still has a way to go before they're reasonably priced again.
Has the depreciation of the dollar, the rise of other currencies against it, given people some compensating value, even if the stocks have gone down some? Has it made up for what people have lost in this market?
Yes, and thanks for the opportunity there, because I didn't want people to think that I was against foreign investment. I think it's very important for investors to have a large part of their portfolio invested in foreign securities. And the dollar has really helped the decline in the dollar has really helped enhance the returns of those foreign investments over the past number of years.
Though their performance straight up, at least on that particular front in China, not so great. Let's get another call. Burlington, Vermont. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hi. My question, I'll turn it around. We save, we spend in an environment. Given the 30-year decline in real wages and the ends of benefits that have made us debtors just to cover basic expenses, what would you folks advise management and government to help us protect our nest eggs?
Looking right off of Wall Street to the wider economy, Kate Scott, I can't help thinking. I mean, here Chris Cordero is a wealth manager. I assume that means he must have clients with a fair amount of skin in the game, of significant investments. And we've got callers who've got $100,000 in or $30,000 in at a different end of the spectrum here. Elizabeth wants to know, it may not be enough to look at Wall Street to help get them through their retirement or the rest of their lives. Should we Should we be looking at the whole economy differently?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. I think what I'm hearing our caller ask is there a responsibility on the part of government or management of companies to do something more or something different?
Straight up on wages, for example.
Well, and I don't really – I think the answer – again, it is partly political, but I think the answer in America is no. Part of what makes the United States economy so great relative to the rest of the world historically is the mobility of assets in the economy, which is a harsh reality for the average worker. It means that they can be hired and fired at will, and you know, there's not a lot relative to the rest of the world. There's not that much government regulation. We have moved to a time when there isn't very much retirement in the way of retirement benefits provided by companies or by government. So it has laid all that responsibility off on the individual. So it is up to us as financial planners and us as individuals to plan better for our retirement years, and that has become more difficult, but it can be done, and it means that we have to really have a better understanding of what we're spending money on and save systematically over the years.
Kate, are your clients generally hanging in there now? Are they as skittish as they've ever been, or sitting tight? Can you generalize?
Our clients are sitting tight. We and I'm sure that all of us online here have counseled our clients over the years to position themselves appropriately for the amount of cash that they might need in the near term, the time horizon for their needs, their retirement or education funding or whatever needs they might have. And then the amount of volatility they can stand. If it's somebody that's very uncomfortable with volatility, even if they're young, they might be 50% in fixed income and 50% in a diversified
equity portfolio.
We're out
with that. Kate Scott, Cheryl Garrett, Christopher Guerrero, thanks to each of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.